Okay, so yes, once again, I'm Debbie, grateful member of Al-Anon. Glad to meet all of you. And are there any newcomers today? Okay. There's other members of the panel we have here.
Hi, I'm Sherry.
I'm Tony.
This is a 50-minute meeting slash panel, and our topic is from delusion and denial to awareness and acceptance. And let's see here. So we've got me, Tony, and Sherry. Mm-hmm. And then going down to, I think, we'll start.
Yeah, start sharing.
Let me just see if I can do this. All right, so from delusion and denial to awareness and acceptance. So first of all, I'd like to thank the part of me that was delusional and in denial and the part of me that's still in denial, if there is some, because there are no bad parts, and I've learned to love every part of myself and see how that part may have served me in the past. And so I grew up thinking I had a great childhood. And that must have served me somehow with my self-esteem or something. And it's very interesting because I drove here this morning from Newport Beach, California. So I've been up since 3:30. And but that's only 4:30 your time, I think. Yeah. So I drove past coming here, the Marine Corps base right there. So part of my story is too, I was in the Marine Corps. So that just sort of brought back some Yeah, other things I can work on and whatnot, you know. And then I really want to thank Al-Anon and all of you and the women from my home group that I see on Zoom at Appreciating Miracles at 3:00 on Wednesdays for helping me to love myself enough that I could become aware and accept and come out of denial and heal. And without that... without that soil and whatnot of this, no giving advice, right? How advice is criticism, right? Unsolicited advice is criticism. We read that in one of my meetings. But it was just accepting me for who I was and not trying to tell me who I am, okay? Because that can trigger me. Like, I've had people try to tell me who I am growing up. You know, I'm trouble, I'm this, I'm that, I'm bad, I'm no. So the first part that I came out of denial with, I mean, I was aware somehow that there was verbal abuse. That's about it, right? And then here I am learning to love myself. And I work as a physical therapist. And I just kept hammering away, and I would continue to work bone on bone. I'm a candidate for a surgery, and I just continue to take all the Advil, Celebrex, all these things, and I keep hurting myself. So I didn't really know where that came from. And then I was working with my sponsor, and she let me know it was okay not to have to seek approval from your parents or think that they were always great and good. Like, she let me know that was okay. And then I realized that, I was physically abused, and I'm carrying it forward where it's okay to abuse myself, and I'm not feeling pain or recognizing pain or feeling feelings or anything like that. So I always had the memory when I was... even growing up, I remember this. My dad, us kids, there was five kids, all born within 5 years, and one home with a bathroom. We were poor, food stamps, et cetera. And so we were exposed to a lot. And my dad worked midnights. And so we would play. And I remember we would accidentally wake him up. And he would come down the hall. I can still see his face right now, and very angry and red and strong, and he would grab and throw us down. And I may have cried one of the times, and maybe I did, but then I learned, and I was trying to teach my brother not to feel. I said, Steve, just tighten up and roll with it. It doesn't even hurt. And I really didn't think that I was being hurt. I didn't feel that physical pain. It's insane, I know. But finally, when I was given permission to look at where this came from for me, or where I got some of my attributes, my survival skills, my defects, my defense mechanisms, these things that I learned how to behave, I realized, oh, wow, some of what I carried forward came from that. So before that, I just saw myself as bad, a bully. I beat up kids on the playground. I just thought I was an awful person. And then I realized, you know, that I learned it somewhere. It wasn't all my fault. And I remember crying and doing my writing and my work and just saying to myself, it wasn't my fault, and that I could forgive myself and be responsible for the harms that I did, but that I was allowed to love myself. And I didn't know that I was allowed to love myself. I didn't even know that I wasn't loving myself. You know, it just, I don't know when that kind, it was so hard. I was doing, I guess, some sort of step work, and I don't remember what, but it had to do, something about, did I ever hate myself? And I was thinking, well, I don't know. Did I hate myself? I don't remember hating myself. But then I remembered one of my daughters, they're 19 now, I have triplets. Yay. And one of them said, Mom, when I parent, I'm going to allow my kids to drink, because when you didn't allow us, we had to talk to another mom, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I said, that's great. And you're going to do a better job than me, and I did a better job than my parents, and they did a better job than their parents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, because I didn't allow them to drink at 15 when all their friends were allowed to, right? So it's like I didn't move forward with that physical abuse. Can you let me know if I have like 2 minutes or three or whatever? However, I did bring forward verbal and emotional. And I didn't even know what all of those were. But then I realized, like, it's emotional, you know, seeing my dad pinning my mom up against the wall, choking her out, and police being called, and these sorts of things that were a regularly occurrence. And I thought I had a good childhood. It's so interesting. I even did a paper when I first started college on, I forgot, it was in my writing class. It was something at junior college, and how it was a positive, the divorce, how it was a positive. I got a B on the paper. Normally I get all A's. I got a B. I was trying to prove a point that probably isn't really backed up by much literature. When I started taking accountability for myself and I realized these things, I was also like angry all the time. I was angry all the time. I was very sarcastic until I looked up the definition of sarcasm, and it had to do with conveying contempt, and that had to do with saying somebody's inferior or not worthy. The definition of the words in there came to like telling someone they're not worthy. And when I learned that, I remembered when my little daughter Savannah was, they're triplets, so you can't help, I guess, you compare and whatnot. That did, that's one of their resentments. The comparing, right? And so one daughter is just like me. She's very quick and sharp and gets it and this stuff. And someone else is gifted in other areas. And I can remember sweet Savannah staring at me, and I said something sarcastic. And now I can still remember her face of, what? Confusion, right? Like, you love me and you're saying this? What does that mean? And I said, ha, 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 Savannah doesn't get sarcasm. You know? Yeah. That was just one of the things. So I have a lot of amends. And when I made amends to her, she said, that's all right. I like sarcasm. So it had already, you know what I'm saying? Because this is, I don't know, last year, the year before when I said that. And it was like, ugh. But you know what? I think she got it. And I think she's looking. And I said, it's what's it's all right, it's just not okay for me, and I'm so sorry because the meaning of it is such and such, and I'm so sorry that I did that. So anyways, yeah, so all those amends, right? And I just, what really helped me though was with Al-Anon was I'm allowed to forgive myself and love myself and put on my oxygen mask, because otherwise I'd be living there with, you know, that and all that beating myself up, right? Because I was always hard on myself, and I'd be beating myself up over doing that to her. But what I've gotten to show my children and my girls, because they just started college, one's in Arizona, Tempe, Arizona, going to ASU, and they got to see me all through, especially COVID. Thank you for that blessing of COVID, because they got me see me doing my meetings, changing, doing all this work, and you know, this, they know that it's spiritual. Like one of them, I have a pet pig, and when it chewed up one of my books, and my daughter, who's like, she, the quick one, she's like, Mom, it looks like the pig's trying to get some spirituality, right? And so they know what I'm doing, and they know it's about love and kindness and compassion and all these things. And yeah, so with Al-Anon, I mean, I just didn't know. I could never get it with just trying to be loving and kind to someone else until I learned to love myself and all parts of myself, the angry part of myself, the child part, the bully on the playground, all these things. And it helps me now, because like if I can love all ages of myself and forgive myself, I can also have compassion to others who might be doing the same behaviors. If somebody's behavior comes out sideways, right, because they're acting out of fear, you know, or mistrust or whatever, it's just, I can see that person now as going, they must have had some trauma. You know, when they're verbally abusive, oh dear Lord, someone must have really said that to them. You know, I was like, you know, watching the Grammys, and you know, someone said a negative on there once again, and it reminded me of when, you know, Kanye West took away that Golden Globe from a 17-year-old Taylor Swift. So you know what I did? I looked up Kanye West, trauma. Yep, he's had trauma. He's had trauma. I know he's had trauma. Why would you act like that unless you've had trauma? So I guess now that's how it's so much easier for me to love and appreciate and care for all people instead of judging them. Because part of my denial, for me, like a pattern of denial is labeling others with their negative traits. So what I'm labeling someone with their negative traits, I'm in denial. And in recovery, I see that I may own some of those negative traits, right? And I thought that I always owned them. I used to say, you spot it, you got it. Remember when you were kids, did anyone remember you smelt it, you dealt it, you denied it, you supplied it, right? That's this topic. And so I learned really easy to see, oh, I'm like that. I'm like that. Every time I was labeling someone, I'm like that. And then my sponsor kindly said one day, or it might be a trigger for you because someone did that to you and maybe you respond the opposite. But I always took things hard, black and white. There was no gray. And so my sponsor taught me to see the gray. It's not always, I'm a bad person, I'm a bad person, and all of that. So now I do that work, right? And I usually am not labeling people other than, you know, saying they're a wounded child or wounded child of God, or maybe they're traumatized. Or I was listening to a wonderful meditation, and it was saying we have all been unskillful at times. At times, we've all been unskillful, maybe with our delivery, unskillful with our response. And so I had to teach myself, because then I learned as an adult, I can teach myself. So in the past few years, I've had to learn how to speak in I statements. Thank you, Al-Anon. And also, you know, nonviolent communication. It's also helps with that, right? I'm speaking in I statements, right? Like if someone were to say something to me, I would say, oh, that hurt, because I have a need for respect. Would you be willing not to speak to me in that way? And then they can say yes or no, right? And so I guess if I have a few minutes left, I'll tap into a little bit of, it was from All Our Affairs. So everything I'm talking about is my own story. It's not from anything, but then I was reading an article and it was from In All of Our Affairs, and it also talked about spiritual abuse, right? And so my spirituality is a lot broader now, you know, and I believe in God, and I would always say that in God, but now I like to say higher power because I believe in a lot of other things and energy and all this sort of stuff. And so I had to unlearn some of the things I had learned that were, to me, a little bit hard or verbally abusive and things like that. So the last time I went home, because I'm from Michigan originally, go Lions, gosh darn it, they lost. My mom, I took her to church, and she's like 80 now, and we sit in the front row, and it's almost, yeah. When I was little, I have the memory, we were running out the door for church, and my finger got slammed in the door as I pulled it out, and it turned to mush. I got lucky this hand surgeon saved the tip of my finger, but guess what? We had to stop at church first. And I had to have and here I am, I can remember me walking down, and it was all bloody and everything. And why did we have to stop at church first? So that she could show everyone, my daughter is injured, I won't be there at the choir today. I don't know. But so we're in church, this is last year, and it's almost time for communion, and I got gum in my mouth, so I go into my purse, I get a piece of paper, and it's making a soft rattle. And my mom looks at me, and she's like, shh. And I'm like, I just laughed because now I'm like, you don't define me. The church doesn't define me. You can't tell me who I am anymore. I know more than that. And I was just like, Mom, I'm putting my gum into a wrapper, okay? And so, you know, I have more compassion for myself today. Before I get off the topic of the spiritual, I was talking to my aunt. It's her birthday. She lives in Florida. She's like 76 today. And so I told her what I was doing. And once I was doing that, we started talking. And then it turned into her telling me what I am. Well, you're marked by God in a positive way, she was saying it. And I just said, you know, I don't really get into the details of that anymore. I don't get into the details of whatever that is. I said, I just know that in this moment, God is in me. My higher power is in me, in every cell of me. And I can believe that, and I can love myself and talk to myself that way and let my body know that I love it and let every part of myself know I love myself and all of that. And so one other example that I have of really learning to love myself and having compassion, you know, like waking up to becoming aware of the truth, right? Of the truth of who I am. Because I used to think who I was, I'm telling you, it was a very, I was in the principal's office all the time. I was a bully on the playground, even later in life, even working as a physical therapist. One of my physician friends let me know I had a black belt in verbal attacks. And I don't do that anymore. There's nothing verbal that's come out of my mouth in quite a while that's been self-deprecating, negative towards myself or others. And I've also learned to work on my thinking. So my, you know, personal third step is think, say, and do, pretty much. So my speech, I'm very cognizant of my speech and the words that I'm using towards myself and therefore others. It helps, you know, because I'm going to treat others the same as myself. And my actions and my thinking has come along that because I've learned that I do have control and power over my thinking and how I'm higher powered now. I've always was. I just didn't know it. I always was this spiritual, loving, compassion, courageous, all these things. I just didn't know it. So when I was in first grade, and I always have this memory, I took a big, thick pencil. It wasn't a number two. And I remember I just went all over the desk, like with angst, right? And just covered it. Got almost that whole desk covered before I got caught. And I had to go to the principal's office. And so I always used to think, I was bad. Nobody liked me. I was trouble. I was always in trouble. I went to the principal's office. And then I was reflecting and I was listening to something. I was listening to something about loving all parts of myself and learning to love myself. And it talked about like how as children, things might have been in respect to what was going on, maybe appropriate, because compared to what was going on at home, I was actually expressing anger in a very good way without hurting others. And I was trying to express maybe that things weren't okay. And nobody asked me. So if I could, you know, schools now have kids get feelings wheels now, I'm hearing, right? And they're learning the feelings chart. And I think they've got school psychologists. And someone might have said, like, so this is how I talk to that first grader now. I hear you. I see you. I'm here. What are you trying to tell me? What are you trying to tell me? And, you know, so I guess I have to go back to Orchard Hills Elementary School and make amends and maybe clean some desks. Or if they would like me to talk to a child that's perceived as angry, I could do that. because now I see that I couldn't do that at home. I couldn't express anger at home. If I was going to express that at home or cry, I never was, you know, cried. Something might happen to me. You know what I'm saying? Oh, thanks. Yeah. So, anyways, it's, you know, because of this program, I can accept, right, my past, and I become aware because I hear other, you know, women and men being vulnerable, and sharing, and I'm open to listening, right, and hearing that there's another side of it to look at. You know, I don't know if anyone watched the Grammys, but I watched it, and Joni Mitchell was on there, and she had the cerebral hemorrhage or whatnot, and now she was singing, and she was singing that song, Two Sides Now, is that what it's called? Both Sides Now, all right. I was listening to that on the way here and allowed myself to cry for seeing the other side of it. I never looked at the other side. And Al-Anon teaches me that there's always more than one side. It's just not this hard, rigid, black and white, all or nothing, good or bad, right or wrong, that there's the gray. And I feel that, you know, I can look at things from another side and look at the gray, and I can be happy and loving myself right now. So thank you.
Thanks, Debbie. That was great. Thank you. Yeah, I will use that. Yeah, you guys can hear me if I speak from here. No? Okay. All right. My name is Sherry. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon, and that was a great share. Thanks, Debbie. Okay. And so, topic is delusion and denial to awareness and acceptance. And I've been kind of thinking about this off and on all week. And for me, where the denial came in, because I was raised in an alcoholic home, and when you're in an alcoholic home, there's a lot of chaos. And in my home, my father was an alcoholic, and my mom was a beautiful enabler. And so she would try to rationalize and justify my dad's behavior, whether, you know, because he would come home drunk and screaming and yelling, or he just wouldn't come home. And then when he didn't come home, my mom was pacing the house up and down, and she would come into her room. Sometimes we'd be in bed. She was at home with four children, you must realize. So there was the distance of age between my oldest brother is only 3.5 years, and then she had her second son, and then she had a set of twins. So we were all within 3.5, 4 years of age to each other. So she was a pretty busy mom. And because dad wasn't there, and she was going crazy when he wouldn't show up. I can have memories of her coming into our room and crying and asking us to pray for dad to make it home safe. And, you know, just being an adult in the house that wasn't able to look after me was drawing on her children to help her deal with the alcoholic. And she just didn't have a clue how to deal with that. And so what happened to me is I became in denial about how hard it was at home, because it was tough to stay at home. By this time, I'm 9 and 10 and 11 and 12, and I'm going to those awareness stages of what my home is really like and that it's different from everybody else's home. And so I would go into denial about what it was. And one of my roles in that house, and I think all of us kids took on a role, was I was the pacifier. And I would either clean to help my mom, and I would get satisfaction from that because I would get recognized for doing something positive. And same with my dad. My mom used to say I was the sugar in his coffee because I was sweet about things where my sister was screaming about things and my brothers were fighting and pushing back. And so my role was kind of the sweet one in the family. And I got satisfaction from that because there was what I perceived as positive outcomes from that. And that's where the delusional came in. So fast forward a few years later, and I saw who my dad was as a person. And so by the time I'm in my late teens, he is very seldom at home anymore and very disconnected from the family. But my mom is still crying and upset because he's not there constantly as a good father. And I remember thinking, gosh, I think you kind of might be better off without him. Like, because when he's home, it's really a lot of chaos here. And then he would come home and he would attempt to be a father. And I would be upset with that because I'm like, who are you? I haven't seen you for 6 months. And now you're supposed to tell me when I'm supposed to come home or how to do homework or anything like that. So I was resentful. But again, my knee-jerk instinct was to get a smile out of him or make my mom feel safe. And so I would do these extra things, even though I didn't want to do them, and that's where people-pleasing came in. But the satisfaction from maybe making that smile happen or perceiving to make my mom feel safe, I wanted more of that. I wanted more of that feeling of what I would have said accomplishment. So that's where my strategies came in for life, was always reacting to a crisis situation in a way that I could fix it. I graduate high school, and as soon as I graduated high school, within a year, my dad divorced my mom, and my mom was completely broken, and I was away about 7 hours away. I lived in a different province at that time, and I would come home to visit my mom, and she was just crushed, laying in bed, crying, and I would try to soothe her with some soft words, but at the same time, I'm thinking, this is going to be okay for you, Mom. Just give it some time. And I fell in love with this handsome, good-looking guy who was, I knew he was drinking and partying a lot, but I was kind of drinking and partying a lot at that time, too, and dysfunction attracts dysfunction, and that's exactly what happened in that situation. And so the vow that I'd made to myself as a young child when I would watch my mom interact with my dad is that I will never be that way. But that's exactly what I turned into, and a really good enabler. Mm-hmm. And as our marriage proceeded and I saw the drinking and drugging increase, and the behavior that goes with that. I'm not saying that my husband was a bad person, but we all know this disease makes us do crazy things, and my disease makes me do crazy things. I act in ways that I wouldn't have acted if I wasn't reacting to the disease of alcoholism. And so I kind of went into denial too. I went into denial that drinking was a problem and I must be doing something wrong, or I have to do something really wrong to get out of this relationship. And the delusional part was this. I want to read this. So I was looking at, what's the best definition of addiction and alcoholics? This is where delusion comes in. So a chronic disease in which a person craves drinks that contain alcohol and is unable, 100% unable to control his or her drinking. A person with this disease also needs to drink greater amounts to get the same effects and has withdrawal symptoms after stopping alcohol use, which is what would happen in our family and in my marriage, is that the alcoholic, my poor husband, would wake up every morning and probably hadn't drank for 6 hours, and he would go into detox. And so I would hear him every morning get out of bed early and sneak into that cupboard and open the door and unscrew that cap, have a couple of drinks, and then put it back. And I would patiently wait in that room, even though I needed to get up and get ready for work and go to the bathroom. And I wouldn't do that until there was some part of me that knew he needed to have that drink to get on with the day. And if you look at addiction, I'm coming to a point about addiction and alcoholism. Addiction is a chronic relapsing order disorder characterized by compulsive drug seeking and use despite adverse consequences. And where my delusion came in is that I thought I could fix that. I am not a doctor. You know, I have no social degree. I am not a psychiatrist. But I really thought, based on my experiences as a young child, that if I said this or I did that, things would be better. And my delusion was thinking that I could control that and that I can control my emotions. And the big thing about being raised in an alcoholic home is the three things that you learn immediately is don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. So those are characteristics that I carried with me. And I'm going to control my husband's drinking when I have no feelings, I don't trust him, and I don't talk about it. And I remember one point, this was actually quite early in the marriage. And he had enough, you know, he almost had a better foundation of relationships than I did, because he says, I feel like you're my roommate and not my wife. And that upset me. But the part that upset me is I actually didn't know what that meant. Like, I'm like, what is a wife supposed to do then? Like, I wasn't going to do what my mom did. And because I thought that she took the hard part of my dad's drinking. She really did it. And I see that now more so than I ever did. And so because I had been determined not to act like her, I tried different ways not to do it. But I still crave that feeling of fixing and controlling. And it's so as time went on in our marriage, that manifested itself in many ways, and none of them good. So I finally got to the point, fear enough, desperate enough, and I started going to Al-Anon. And when I started going, I thought, how can I explain this to my husband without offending him, even though I didn't like his drinking and I was resentful and mad all the time? So I said, I think I better start going to Al-Anon because I got to deal with my dad's drinking. Because it was obvious that he was an alcoholic, and it was easy to focus on him as the excuse to go instead of my own. And so then when I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting, of course, I have wanted to moan and groan about my relationship and how the alcoholic was doing this to me, and he was saying this to me and being mean to me. And I wanted all you in the Al-Anon rooms to feel sorry for me, take my hand and hold it and said, you know what, you just leave him and come and live with me or something like that. I don't know, I was expecting miracles. You poor thing. That's what I wanted. And I came to a lot of meetings to hear that, and I never did. What I heard was it was time to look at myself. And that was when the awareness started coming in. The awareness that my marriage wasn't a total breakdown because of the alcoholic and his disease. It was a breakdown, too, because of my own disease. And I needed to look that first. I couldn't do anything about that marriage until I looked at myself. And so I came in realizing that, yeah, you know what? I did make mistakes. And I had these preconceived notions of what I had needed to do in that marriage that I had picked up as a child. Like, I'm sorry, a 9-year-old does not go into a 26-year-old or 27-year-old's mind and person and say, okay, I'm going to start tutoring you on how to have a relationship and a marriage. But that's exactly what happened. I was listening to that 9-year-old instead of this. Because this 27-year-old girl didn't know what to do anyway. And so when I realized that those rules that I had set for myself didn't apply now, I had to look at the 12 steps. And I realized that that was my strategy for living. I could get out of that survival mode of, I almost look at it like a, what's that game when you throw things at each other and you're supposed to, dodgeball. That's almost what I felt like. Dodgeball with wrenches, you know. You hate that one. And so I had to stop and look at the steps and say, well, maybe I should start using these. Maybe I could start using these in my personal life, and that might help in my marriage. And so that's where awareness came in. So as a result of that, so what do you do? And it really comes down to the basics, and I still forget that to some days. Go to meetings, talk to your sponsors, or read your literature. And the biggest part of my recovery, which was huge for me, was starting to go to open meetings and hearing the alcoholics share their stories. And I would be sitting beside my husband, because by this time we had made a commitment. I had left him, but we had made a commitment. He had gone through his own recovery process, and I was working on mine. And we're going to try this marriage the right way before we say 100% no. So we would go to open meetings, and there'd be somebody up there sharing their story. And my husband was sitting beside me nodding his head. And that was the first time I became aware, oh, you guys, that brings up lots of emotion. I feel so terrible. That, you know, my poor husband had horrible, terrible feelings about what he was doing. I didn't realize that he didn't want to wake up every morning and drink and act like an a-hole and be miserable. I thought he was doing that to me. I thought I was the problem. That, and that wasn't it. He didn't want to do that. That was never his intention. But that's what the disease does. And who did I think I was that I could fix that? I couldn't. And so as a result of going to this open meetings, and I'll never forget this, is that we were sitting at one, and I heard a number of speakers, and I was starting, in my head, I recognized it as a disease. And I could intellectually say those words and understand those, but it didn't come through into in my heart yet. And there was this guy, and I don't know why, but let me tell you, if you go to enough open meetings, it will happen to you. It really will. It will come from head to heart that you will understand this is an ugly disease and we have no control over it. And this guy was sharing the story about he's married, he has a couple of kids, and that day is like Christmas Eve, and he promised himself, like, I'm sure he would have sworn a Bible, that he was going to come home after work and be with his family on Christmas. And he went to the bar after work, get off early, went to the bar, and didn't make it home. And the pain in his voice as he was recounting that story just hit me right in the heart. And I knew it was a disease, and what a relief. And so even today, we've got quite a bit of sobriety and recovery in our house. And some days I'm on good enough emotional and spiritual ground that I can see the difference between my husband and the disease. And hopefully, I pray for him too, that sometimes he can see Sherry and the disease, because my disease still manifests itself too. And so today, my goal is, how do I avoid delusion and denial? That is by talking at a meeting and being honest. And so I have to share, when I first started coming into Al-Anon, I did not want to share the ugly stuff. I didn't want to share how I really felt and how it made me mean, and I was resentful. And I remember sitting across from somebody, and they shared about how they planned their husband's funeral. And I'm like, oh my God, me too. And but you know, like, I love that. And I loved how experienced members shared their pain. And experienced members weren't scared to talk about the ugly stuff and how they felt. And here was a room that was safe with non-judgmental people willing to listen to the ugly stuff and say, you're okay, and you're going to make it keep coming back. Like, I hadn't had that in my own home. Like, if I had a thought that I was disappointed about what my parents are doing or not doing, like, it was basically shut up and go to your room. I mean, that's how they dealt with it. Some of that's generational too. I realized when you're talking about how we talk to our kids, definitely that's the goal. As my goal, when I keep coming to meetings now, is to stop that disease of alcoholism continuing in our family. Because you shake my family tree and they're falling out left, right, and center. We have a hailstorm of alcoholics and addicts in my family. And so I keep coming back to meetings because the disease is still with me, and I'm still married to an alcoholic who is in recovery. But together, as we practice this program, the awareness and the acceptance is way more relevant and in my face than it ever used to be. And for that, I'm grateful. And I really appreciate you guys coming to listen to us today. And thanks very much. I'm going to pass it over to Tony.
Hi, I'm Tony, and I am a member of Al-Anon. Where should I start? Well, I'll tell you. I did a lot of my mother was an alcoholic, and I had no idea until like just the last few years. I was probably at the age of 4 or 5 when she stopped drinking. But then what happened with me was I came into Al-Anon 14 years ago, and I decided that it was about me and making myself feel better. So. And I got into the records for like deeds, and then I would get I went through all the places where I lived, where I was conceived, and where we moved from point A to point B, and then I would go visit these places, and Well, what happened was at the age of 4 or 5, I had a traumatic experience that caused me to start wetting the bed again. And I was very upset about it. And it, my dad had, and my dad's cousin and then another person had got me, pinned me down and gave me a shot between the legs. And it caused me to start wetting the bed, and I did not appreciate it. So I became very angry. And it was right at that time that my mother stopped drinking. It's fascinating because, well, I also got into a record where my mother's grandfather had alcoholism written across his death certificate. And he died in 1912, I believe, and he had 3 sons that they took away from him after his wife died, after she had had her, I believe it was her third son, I believe. And they were going onto the orphan train, and they got on the phone at the courthouse and called the farms around the outer side of the town, and they were all farmed out to the different farms and raised in that way, and they all did well after that. But and then I got into my dad's side of the family, and he was his house that he. I came to the conclusion that he was an illegitimate son of what would be my uncle. It would be his dad. And he kept real quiet about it, real quiet. And his, well, it really gets interesting because the household that he was raised in, my grandparents, which would be actually be my great-grandparents, if I'm right, I'm the only one that really thinks that, and they had a very healthy household. They had 7 kids, and they were all one after the other. And they were from Europe, and they were here. My grandfather came through the World War I, and I just started looking at their records. And what I did was I'd go to the phone books, and I would look at everybody's where they lived, and they all my uncles married and then moved back in with my grandparents, and they lived with them shortly, and then they would save enough money and they would buy a house, and they lived in that house for the rest of their life. So I knew them that way. But my grandfather was very industrialized. He had grapes, he grew them, he took care of them. He had a phenomenal amount of winemaking equipment, and he always had a 50-gallon wine barrel in the basement full of wine. He always kept it full. So I started... And I did not know that either until I started to ask questions. At any rate, yeah, you can find a lot of stuff out by going and starting to dig in the courthouses and looking at the deeds and going to the phone books and checking out where everybody lived, driving by it. Just a lot of memories come back. What happened was when I started wetting to bed, all my memories left me from the age of 5 prior to that. And I had made a decision at that point because of something other that happened. At any rate, so I would guess that my dad's dad was an alcoholic, and he was raised by his grandparents, who were my grandparents now, because they became his parents. My dad, when I worked with him all the time, and we would get up on very tall buildings, and at the age of 6, I suppose. 6 or 7, we'd get up on these buildings, and he had just nudged me when I was looking over the side. I wouldn't know he was behind me. He would just come up and he'd nudge me, and he would do that on every job. And the last job, at first it was very alarming, but it's just, you know, the abusiveness was always there, both for my mother, for my dad, and I became very isolated. I became angry. All the energies of anger, hatred, fear, violence are from wrong perceptions. I had grown into this perception that's how family was. And I can still today, and Al-Anon directed me to these, looking up these, all this research and whatnot. And so I came out of it pretty well. And I understand where I think I've always liked myself. It's the problem is that the energies of anger and violence and fear and hate are there, and I always would use them in some way or another to cover for my feelings. And I could always turn and look at them and say, that wasn't the right thing to do, but, you know, I did it, and so now what, you know? And I mean, right, we lived in the country, so and my mother kept a cabinet next to the refrigerator full of alcohol, and they all had, you know, little bits of amounts, and them amounts never changed. My entire 13 years, we moved to the country about 5 miles outside of town at the age of 4 or 5, and that's when she stopped. And I can remember now when I started going back through my old houses where I was concealing everything, I remember her being very promiscuous. Now, I don't know how you would call promiscuous, but I can remember everything. Everything started coming back. And I can remember walking about a quarter mile to go get her because she had left all of us. I was the oldest. We had four. There were four of us, and I was the oldest, and I had three siblings. And I went up to this house to get her, and she was there, it was kind of interesting. She turned the woman. I'm sure she was drunk now, and she must have been. I don't know what, because she had left us at the house, and I was like going, "What in the heck?" Because we had a baby, and then a 2-year-old, and a 1-3-year-old, and I was 4 or 5, and I'm yelling at her. And at any rate, so we walked back to the house, but yeah, I can remember that kind of stuff, and it's you know, it was just the way that it was. But things really changed after she got sober, and I'm just starting to look back and realize that was probably a good thing. And actually, my dad never said a word to me the entire time I worked with him. And I would go work. I worked with him a lot on it was construction. And I did not like that. And I had told myself at the age of 4 or 5 that as soon as I had the chance that I would leave my where I was at, I was gone. And I knew where I was going to go when I left. And I did that at the age of 18. When I left. It was a large metropolis. I went to the cemetery, and when I got there, it was the first time I'd been there since this traumatic incident had happened at the age of 4 or 5, or I think it was 65, so I'd have been 6 probably, 5 or 6. But all those memories came back. But now at this point, and I thought, oh, my God, and all that dirt fell out of my hair, you know, I thought, oh, my, you know, I got to do, you know, okay, I see what's going on here. There were a lot of memories that came back. And, but I was I got into alcohol and drugs at that point. And that's the other side of my story. I got sober fairly young at the age of 23. So alcohol is everywhere. When I got back to came back to the town I was in, I'm from Omaha, Nebraska, and when I came back there, I did not want to come back there. I joined the military for 4 years in the Navy. I never came home. I didn't want to come back home. That's a whole other long story. But that's just kind of the denial of it. That is the denial and the delusion. It's all there. And it's very simple. It's today I can understand when I go to an Al-Anon meeting, I can get into the I can develop a deep and compassionate listening to people that are in there. And I have to develop it. At first, I couldn't figure it out for whatever reason. And now I'm beginning to develop the outward part to where there's kind of some sort of a loving speech or something that I can come up with, I guess, you know, an understanding way. But that is, you know, still today, it's an ongoing deal. I have to realize when I start to pull up fear from that situation and hate from this situation, and this is my dad, my brother, my sister, my grandfather, and I start putting it in front of me, there's no longer a narrow road that I'm focused on. I've got all this stuff there, and it's all a wrong perception when I start throwing it all together. So once I realize that, then I got to step back and go, oh boy, you know, I better meditate or do something. So, you know, there's practices that I can do today that I understand a lot better than I used to before. I mean, I have intimacy with God today. I can, that I don't believe anybody else comes near that, although I would understand that as not coming near anything of ancient days either, but that's a whole other thing in whatever you want to look at, however you want to look at it. So I'm pretty happy with what I've, with where I've been. I've always been, but now I just got a better understanding of a better way to move forward in my own disposition with myself, and then that helps me to perceive other people in a much better perception, it just makes everything more liberating. It makes much more better for everybody, and that's a better thing. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you, everybody. So in closing, I would like to say that the opinions expressed here were strictly those of the person who gave them. Take what you liked and leave the rest. The things you heard were spoken in confidence and should be treated as confidential. Keep them within the walls of this room and the confines of your mind. A few special words to those of you who haven't been with us long. Whatever your problems, there are those among us who have had them too. If you try to keep an open mind, you will find help. You will come to realize that there is no situation too difficult to be bettered and no unhappiness too great to be lessened. We aren't perfect. The welcome we give you may not show the warmth we have in our hearts for you. After a while, you'll discover that though you may not like all of us, you'll love us in a very special way, the same way we already love you. Talk to each other, reason things out with someone else, but let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the understanding, love, and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time.
Just one announcement before we completely close. Is that there's another meeting here at 3:00. There's like these incredibly fantastic people that are going to share at the panel meeting at 3:00. And if you have a question, I'm putting my guest panel speakers on the spot here. Don't hesitate, Kate, to talk to one of us if you have any questions or anything. We're here for you. Thanks.
Okay. Will all who care to join me in closing with the Al-Anon Declaration? Let it begin with me. When anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, let the hand of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen always be there, and let it begin with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.